The ability to play means we can indulge in a kind of illusion, not delusion, and make a distinction. It always amazes me that when the patient arrives, they like the routine of an analysis. Nobody breaks that. It's an illusion. It's a piece of theater every time we open the door to our patients and they lie on the couch. And yet there's something enormously gratifying as the patient works out their sense of reality from that illusory field, we could say. But I think it is exactly what the mother is able to bring to the infant, this capacity to play and this capacity to continue to evolve beyond the analysis. It's an internalization of that experience of being listened to and being with someone, as I tried to emphasize earlier. And the details of that, I think, is related to an intrapsychic surviving and non-surviving object and the analyst who continues to think and feel and be with the patient in the consulting room.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest interviewer today is Dr. Joel Whitebook. Dr. Whitebook has interviewed on this podcast before, and as recently as this past October on episode 144, he interviewed our guest today, Dr. Jan Abram, who is going to continue her conversation on Winnicott. The first conversation was on why Winnicott, and today it will be on why Winnicott Part 2, with a special focus on the surviving object, a fascinating notion that she will unpack for us and will share with us both its theoretical and its clinical importance. A few words about Joel. For those who don't know him, he is a philosopher and a psychoanalyst. He's on the faculty of the Columbia University Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, and he was the founding director of the university's psychoanalytic studies program. He's very widely published. He is probably best known for two books, one of which is called Perversion and Utopia, and in particular, his book, Freud, An Intellectual Biography. I said it on the first introduction I made of his being a guest interviewer. It really is a must read for those who really want to get a real three-dimensional sense of Freud's development. With no further ado, I will turn the mic over to Dr. Joel Whitebook.
Okay, first, I would like to thank Harvey for giving Jan and me the opportunity to do another interview. At the end of the last one, I think all three of us felt that there was still a lot of material to go into and that we had barely scratched the surface. Furthermore, in my overzealousness to be a responsible moderator, I actually cut the interview short, so we could have even gone further then. But let's proceed to today's discussion. Let me begin by introducing Jan, who is a practicing analyst in London, who, in addition to being a training and supervising analyst of the British Psychoanalytic Society, is also a visiting professor at the psychoanalysis unit at University College London, and is the current president of the European Psychoanalytic Federation. Among her many publications, I will mention only a few. First, the very important, The Language of Winnicott, The Clinical Paradigms of Melanie Klein and Donald Winnicott, which she co-authored with Bob Henchelwood, and her most recent book, The Surviving Object, which we will actually be discussing today. So having said that, let's proceed to our discussion. And though I don't want to be too formal, I have actually written up some questions in the hope that it will help us focus things and have a more fruitful discussion. So my first question is this. Last time we touched on the topic of aggression, because I think it is important, I would like to return to it. It is often said that compared to Freud and Klein, Winnicott didn't have a developed or sophisticated theory of aggression. In the language of Winnicott, however, Jan, have shown that he had a very sophisticated developmental theory of aggression, which begins with primary aggression and culminates in the role that the destruction of the object plays in the constitution of reality, something Freud didn't really appreciate. Also, his idea of ruthlessness played a very important part in his theory. So in addition to this, which you written earlier, in your most recent book, The Surviving Object, you have attempted to develop Winnicott's ideas in the use of the object even further. So I'm going to ask you two things, Jan. First, can you tell us in more detail about Winnicott's developmental theory of aggression? And then after that, can you tell us about your own theory of the surviving object in which you attempt to develop Winnicott's theory further?
Thank you, Joel. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Harvey Schwartz and you, Joel, again, for having me a second time. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to continue the conversation on why Winnicott, and especially on the theme of aggression in his work, which I think is really key. So let me try to address the first question. You're right that there are many misunderstandings, I think, about his theory, as well as accusations regarding his inability clinically to address the patient's aggression in the analytic situation. In fact, this myth has rather spread by many analysts about the independent school of psychoanalysis. And I feel it's important to say this to begin with, because I believe it's occurred for many reasons, far too many to go into here, but succinctly, mostly the independents, and especially Winnicott, disagreed with both the Freudian death instinct, but perhaps especially the Kleinian version of the death instinct, especially as it was being developed in the 1950s. And it's become one of the foundation stones of the Kleinian paradigm. So the myth or misunderstanding went, or still sometimes goes, like this. An analyst who disagrees with the concept of the death instinct is avoiding their own aggression, i.e. hate, sadism, and especially envy. And so by not interpreting these affects, the analyst will reinforce the patient's aggression, death drive, the patient's pathology. Therefore, not interpreting the envy straight away is seen as an avoidance and infers that the analyst has a problem with their own aggression. Moreover, only an analysis that addresses the patient's aggression can be called an analysis. Now, this kind of generalization doesn't help a dialogue between analysts in the way, as you've just mentioned, the book that Bob Hinchelwood and I, the two books now that we've attempted to try and tease these areas out in the last two books on Winnicott and Klein and Winnicott and Bjorn. In fact, in the Winnicott and Klein book, you'll remember that in the appendix, we had a myth section, in fact, because I think Bob felt that the independents have myths about the Kleinians and the Kleinians have myths about the independents. And we really tried to spell that out. So it reminds me of Freud in his first clinical monograph, you know, the case of Dora in 1905. We can see for Freud, he believed the only way to cure the hysteric symptom was to interpret the Oedipal configuration. When he insists on telling Dora that she's in love with her father, it comes across, when we all read that text now, as an explanation. I'm sure it was aimed to help her. But while nowadays we all know that it's not false, I think the majority of analysts now, I don't think you can really be an analyst unless you recognize the Oedipus complex, but we take care nowadays to find a way of helping the patient see this in their own way and their own time. In fact, what I like about that passage, I was thinking in the Dora paper, and you'll remember it, is that when Dora says to Freud, "Well, I don't know," she then has a memory of being at a party, do you remember, with the little seven-year-old girl who points to the seven-year-old girl's mother and whispers to Dora, "You can't imagine how I hate that person." And it's a lovely example of where Freud shows the reader that he got the interpretation right. And we wouldn't disagree with him. But it's not so much the interpretation, but the way in which the patient responds to it. And nowadays, it's also about the timing of the interpretation. And I think Winnicott's emphasis on facilitating the patient's understanding of their inner world rather than the analyst knowing about their inner world. So I think whilst there would be a sort of general interpretation, a general agreement, sorry, about interpretation, somehow giving a patient an interpretation of the unconscious mind without the patient getting to pre-conscious areas of the mind is seen to be possibly traumatic.
Jan, may I interrupt here? Because I'm actually planning to ask you about the relation of experience and insight in one of the later questions, and yes. What you're saying about Dora's really Dora really bears on it. For now, however, could you tell us about the way you presented Winnicott's own developmental theory of aggression, beginning with muscle erratism and going all the way through to the use of the object? I mean, I'd like to get the Winnicottian position on the table, and then we can come back, and your own position on the surviving object, and then we'll come back to experience and insight later.
Yeah, I bring all of that in, though, Joel, because I feel it's really important to see that Winnicott was a Freudian to begin with. You know, he was analysed by James Strachey. And so all of this was in his mind. But his theory of aggression from the disagreement with Freud of the death instinct and then with Melanie Klein, especially on the envy and innateness of the death instinct, as she put it, brought him to the use of an object. So from the start of his work, and of course I realized while I was preparing for Language of Winnicott, that aggression took him about understanding the aggression in the infant going through to mature object relations, probably took him about 40 years before he arrived at the formulation of the use of an object. And he is concluding that it's relational and not innate, even though biology is involved in it. So fundamentally, he sees that aggression is benign. He likens it to fire in his late work. It, to begin with, it's the infant's activity and motility, muscle erotism, as you've just mentioned, primary aggression. And as the infant grows and develops, it's going to change its quality in relation to the parent-infant relationship. But he never agreed with the idea that envy, hate, and sadism were innate. They were affects that came about through maturity. And I think the misunderstanding is that so many analysts who've not made a close reading of Winnicott leap to a conclusion that he didn't believe in envy, hate, and sadism existing. But this is an absurd conclusion because hate and the countertransference. What am I not giving you?
You know, I want to interject something here. I think the point that you're making now is connected to his disagreement with Klein about the nature of the object. What for Klein was the original object was for Winnicott what he called the subjective object. It still was in the internal world. And his difference with her is that you have to go beyond the subjective object and actually have reference to the object in the environment, the extra psychic object. And this is the point I wanted to make to reinforce what you're saying. I think his argument was you can't have affects like hate and envy until the object has been constituted. You have to explain.
This is exactly what I'm coming on to.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'll keep my mouth shut.
No, it's fine. I feel that it's important to do it in sequence order to contextualize where he arrives at this. Because you're not wrong, but everything that you've just said is exactly what I'm coming to, Joel.
Okay, I'll cease and desist.
And I do want to mention about the misunderstanding, because you see, in 1947, he wrote Hate and the Countertransference, where he shows very clearly a relational understanding of hatred, that it evolves. And he describes, you'll remember, how the baby induced the mother's hatred. Remember, he gives 18 reasons why the mother hates her baby from birth. And this is the good enough mother who hates her baby. But the first reason that she hates her baby, you'll remember, is that the baby's not her own conception. Took me years. I still am not sure whether I really understand that. But it does take years to get that first reason. Obviously, it's related to the mother's fantasy of what kind of perfect baby she's going to have. And then 3 days later, after she's given birth to the baby, she realizes this baby has a mind of its own and has a personality of its own. So I imagine that's what he means by the first reason that the baby is not her own conception, is the first reason why she hates the baby. Now, it all depends, of course, on her primary maternal preoccupation. And this facilitated the infant's aggression to evolve and integrate. And this is how he brought in the theory of perception, which is the philosophical area which you'd have a lot to say about, Joel. But I really think aggression is central to his final theoretical contribution and pivotal to so many of his other concepts, from antisocial tendency, creativity, transitional phenomena, true and false self, and then the use of an object. So this is where I can now go into how I understand the use of an object and address the second part of your question. So my proposal, which of the dual concept for an intrapsychic surviving and non-surviving object, has probably taken me the best part of 30 years to clarify, and it still needs further elaboration, I'm sure. But in my collection of the selected clinical papers of the surviving object, I trace the way in which these ideas have begun to take shape since 1996. Now, let me just set out the sequence that Winnicott writes about in The Use of an Object. And in Donald Winnicott Today, I suggested that this is really where he finally, I think, comes up, and I think he's pleased by it, because he finally comes up with the concept that for him, he never quite says it like this, but I think he was pleased with it because it replaces the notion of a death instinct. You don't need a death instinct if you have this concept. So there are five steps to the sequence. Subject relates to object. Object is in process of being found. Third, subject destroys the object. Fourth, object survives destruction. And then the fifth, subject can use object. Now, I've suggested that this dynamic constitutes mature subject-object relations. And the dynamic sequence, I think, is at the heart of the psyche's healthy evolution. And we discussed health last time on this podcast. So finally, for Winnicott, he can start to address what is it that makes life worth living? And what is it that gives the human being a sense of feeling real? And in the analyzing situation, as you know, he stresses listening and waiting in the use of an object for the analysan to discover their true self rather than interpreting too soon in the way I've just described that Freud, I think, did. And he felt that many of his colleagues were going from conscious to unconscious too quickly. There was no transition. There was no pre-conscious. So several further formulations he was making in Playing and Reality. And from this, such as capacity to play, capacity for concern, the fear of breakdown, mirror role of mother, creativity, so many in that book. I think of Playing and Reality as Winnicott's metapsychology. But I'll just say something. It's just a bit more, and obviously I'll have to say it quite succinctly, about the idea of an intrapsychic surviving and non-surviving object. When Winnicott says, you'll remember that very probably overquoted part where he says, the subject says to the object, I destroyed you, and the object is there to receive the communication. Now, what I'm suggesting is that he ushers right there the notion of an intrapsychic surviving object implicitly. This specific moment in object relating implies the creative use of an intrapsychic subjective surviving object that has experienced the object's survival, that has in turn contributed to the infant's subjective sense of having been survived. It's something about having been survived, which I think is actually the meaning of love, of being loved. And the key part of the sequence is that the object is there to receive the communication, which must refer to the mother, the analyst, who is able to receive the infant's loving destruction, which is ruthless. And I think this is what constitutes psychic survival of the object. And I'm saying that I think that this dynamic process facilitates the subject to internalize an experience of not only being survived, but being recognized. And despite the intense demands on the mother's body, what I referred to last time as the psyche body, she continues to adapt to the helpless infant's needs and their need to survive. And her ability to survive means essentially she never retaliates. This thing of retaliation, I think, is so key in all human relationships. And it's essential, he says, to the use of an object. And the process I'm suggesting throughout my book is at different levels of development, this dynamic sequence goes on interpersonally. It's probably going on right now between you and I, Joel. So, as you know, I continue to elaborate that with several clinical examples where I'm referring to an intrapsychic subjective object, which evolves beyond the phase of merger into an internal surviving object. So the intrapsychic surviving object becomes an internal object, emanating from the intrapsychic subjective object.
Two things occurred to me when I read your book, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that first, the idea of the surviving object is an elaboration of the notion of the good object, or a change in an elaboration. The good object isn't one that's just gratifying, but it's one that survives. And secondly, the idea the use of the object is a reinterpretation of the notion of reparation. What results from the experience of surviving object is a capacity for concern. And I think concern becomes the new concept rather than reparation.
Yeah, I do address these points in the book, but let me first of all say that it isn't an alternative to, it's a different theory, and it is very different from a Kleinian good object.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, Winnicott did not, he wanted to get away from value judgments. So although we could agree that an intrapsychic surviving object is good, you see, that's why he used the term good enough. He wanted to get away from the notion of a good internal object from birth and a bad internal object. What he, I think, was referring to, and that's why I like this notion of survival of the object, that it's not value judgment. It's from an intrapsychic surviving object that you can perceive what is good and bad, that you can discern what is good and bad. But you have to have the experience of your innate desire and aggression and all the things that the baby, the ruthless demands that the baby has to bring before they know they're ruthless. You have to have that survived by the mother, and you can then look back and say, I was ruthless then, as he says. And this is then the capacity to discern. And it's not until that point that you start reparation. There's no reparation to begin with.
I think that's very interesting that in a way he's concerned not to be moralistic or moralizing. So he speaks exactly more in functional or descriptive terms. And as I read those passages as a philosopher, something else very interesting occurs to me. One of the big problems in moral philosophy, especially in Kant, is that the demands of morality always seem to come from the outside. They always seem external. They always seem to impinge on the self. But in Winnicott, he says, unless you have developed the capacity for concern, which is the result of having experienced the surviving object, morality will always seem like an external burden. But once you develop the capacity for concern, then being moral is something that is more egosatonic to you. It's not like an external foreign demand.
Exactly. You can't reach a capacity for concern without the experience of having felt that you have survived. In other words, there has not been an experience of retaliation. And I think I don't know what Winnicott would say, but this is what I'm saying. I think in the paranoid, schizoid position, that in a Kleinian paradigm is innate and universal. It's a description of retaliation. In fact, the whole Kleinian paradigm is based on the conviction that this is what the baby feels from the beginning. They feel that they are being retaliated against. Whereas in Winnicott's good enough mother, who is the real woman, she protects the infant from feeling that by not retaliating. And that's why the whole notion of survival of the object is so key. And yeah, I think what you've just said is helpful, actually, because then what we see is much more the importance of the capacity for concern emanating from this intrapsychic surviving object that is absolutely relational.
Let me add one more formulation to sum this section up, and then we'll move on. The paradox here is that you have to accept your own destructiveness before you can develop a capacity for concern and become really moral.
Yes, and you also have to know that you have an intrapsychic non-surviving object too. This is also what I develop, that there's always an oscillation between the two. Like, for instance, when we're ill, when we feel really mad in an environment that genuinely is persecuting, and where we struggle to work out what is me and what is not me, what is real and what is not real. And really, it's a struggle in life, but there are certain situations that every human being is in where that is particularly, a particular crisis. That's where we're tested most of all.
Okay, let me move on to my next question, which you already anticipated when I interrupted you a bit when you mentioned Dora. But last time you did bring up the topic that Winnicott stressed experience, the importance of centrality of experience in the clinical setting. What I wanted to ask you about is more recently, I don't know if this is true in the UK, but in the States, Ogden's distinction between the ontological and the epistemological approach has gained widespread usage, where he tries to correct an overly cognitivist or intellectualized clinical approach with one which is more experiential. Now, I certainly agree with all that, but I also sometimes see a tendency to swing too far in the other direction, and experience sort of becomes the royal road to the cure, so to speak. And in many articles that I read and case presentations that I hear, experience, especially the idea of reverie, seems to be the source of mutative experience, if you want to put it that way. And often in these cases, you don't hear much about the case presentations, you don't hear much about the patient's history, developmental history, nor is there much attempt to formulate the case. So my concern is that stressing the ontological or the experiential, while important, can swing too far in the other direction. Therefore, I'd like to ask you to say something about the relation of experience and insight in Winnicott. I mean, you already mentioned the fact that he said we shouldn't be too clever. But I think what follows from that is we have to let the patient arrive at their own insight and not impose it on them from on high, which means insight still plays an important role. The question is how it comes about in analysis.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I find this distinction between ontological and epistemological, although these are very particular terms coming from another discipline, but I think they do identify something that certainly resonates with me. As I said in my endorsement for Tom Ogden's book on coming to life in the consulting room, which I think is really relevant to your question, how we facilitate our patients to come to life. You're right that Winnicott eschewed intellectualizing, and that, of course, would be, I think he would say, that if you give a deep interpretation in the way that I describe Freud did to Dora, then you are likely to get an intellectualizing from the patient, or he would say a compliant patient. There's no real connection between what the patient feels they're evolving and what the patient feels about themselves. What they feel is true. They'll be taking something that they feel their analyst wants to take as true. And compliance, as he said, is no life at all. And that's no analysis either. So I think that we could see that that distinction can be quite useful. It was reminding me of Winnicott in chapter 4 of Playing and Reality, where he's writing about playing and the search for the self. And at the end of that rather long chapter, the patient asks Winnicott a question, and he says, well, if I started to answer that question, we'd have a very long and interesting discussion. But what I'm interested in is that you ask the question. And this led to the patient saying, yes, I see that that relates to an existence of a me from the question. And that's as important as the searching. And I think it's such a good example of what you're asking about, really, where there was an experience and how he facilitated the patient to get away from an intellectualizing of the question, but just to go back to where did the question come from? And it came from a me. This was a patient that was really struggling to be in contact with her sense of reality. So I think that was all, as Winnicott says, related from something primary, a primary creativity that he was able to facilitate for that patient at that given moment. He also says at the end of that chapter, it came about from relaxation rather than integration, which is also really important. And how can a patient relax on the couch unless they trust the analyst? And that takes many years, as you know.
Put it in a different language. I mean, maybe it's the older language of ego psychology. You could also describe this as the patient identifying with the analyst's own curiosity.
Yes, I like that.
Okay. Last time I brought up the point that Winnicott introduced the concept of the environment. Because Winnicott introduced the concept of the environment, relational analysts often claim him for their position, which de-emphasizes the unconscious or inner reality. In response to that last time, you said what you understood as the environment was the mother's internal world, which was very interesting, but which I think needs some elaboration and explanation. So can you tell us what you meant by that?
Well, you'll remember that last time I referred to the mother's psyche body, because we could say her mind, but I like psyche body because it includes, it refers to everything, who she is, who she's come from,
Maybe I misinterpreted you when I said the mother's internal world. Maybe it was psyche body that you had said.
I mean, increasingly, I prefer to refer to the mother's psyche body than the object, even though I know the object is, you know, technical language in psychoanalysis. But I just wonder how we all deny the actual mother and the power of the mother's mind and the mother's psyche body with her infant. And how I always refer to Winnicott referring to the environment, it's psyche, it's the psychic environment. And I think it encapsulates her psyche body encapsulates all of that. But I do want to bring in the father here, the father's role. And this, of course, relates to the concept of aggression, as I point out in language of Winnicott. Because he's also crucial for the infant, although he's not as powerful as the mother. I don't think many of us want to really acknowledge that. Because if she decides to cut out the importance of his role, this is likely to lead to mental illness. And this brings us back to the end of our last podcast, Joel, you'll remember, that the importance of biology and the reality principle in relation to each one of us. We all need to know where we come from, even if our biological parents are not the parents that are looking after us. It's essential that we know where we come from originally, I feel. And it's the truth about each human being. And that relates also to the fear of woman. And the fear of woman that relates to what Winnicott described as the fear of dependency. And it's the fear of woman in all of us, not just men and women, in all of us, there is a fear of woman. And I think that's related to how powerful the mother is.
Well, again, you've anticipated one of my questions, so I will jump to it. Winnicott certainly wasn't a social critic, a overt social critic. But it's clear that he had his eye on what was going on in the wider world and was very concerned with a lot of the maladies that are plaguing modern society. And he makes comments in passing that indicate that, but that are also very suggestive. At one point, he says, en passant, he said, if I had time to go into this, I would. He said, it's like dependency, the fact that dependency is the fundamental problem that we all have to work through. And in order to avoid, he didn't use the word an authoritarian society, he does use the word democracy, in order to promote a democratic society, it's necessary for the society to work through their dependency and fear of dependency. And I'll say in passing, this is especially true today with the ecological crisis, where we have to come to grips with our dependency on nature and the limits of our omnipotence. But in addition to bringing up the question of democracy, this notion of the fear of dependency, as you just began to indicate, is also connected with feminism and misogyny. Because, as you quoted him as saying, he said, the fear of woman is in all of us. And this is what leads to misogyny and also to, you might say, grandiose machismo, my terminology. And that the fear of woman in both men and women, men and women, is because woman symbolizes, embodies dependency. And there's a primordial fear of dependency in all of us. So would you care to elaborate on this? You began to. I'm inviting you to.
Yeah, actually, Winnicott never said it was the roots of misogyny. That was me.
Okay.
In language Winnicott, which it just seems very obvious that I think it must be the roots of misogyny, because the roots of misogyny must be related to a fear. And so when I started exploring, because he doesn't really say much, there are only five papers where he mentions fear of woman. He doesn't really develop it. And that's what I tried to develop in chapter four of The Surviving Object. When I worked with a particular patient who was terrified of analysis as well as afraid of being a mother, becoming a mother, because it related to her becoming a woman. And of course, we can see this in Dora. We can see this in The Hysteric, actually. But there's a fear of what it means to become a woman. And that, I think, must lead back to Dora, Dora's relationship with her mother and her mother's relationship to her, and what we get there related to the symptoms of hysteria. So I think, as you've pointed out, Joel, on many occasions in your work too, that Winnicott really does address something that Freud did not. And so it's not to throw Freud out. On the contrary, it's that complement of early psychic object relations and the Freudian paradigm and how psychoanalysis has developed to today. And I think, just to say, I think you're right about the power of the female body and what that represents.
As I tried to show it, in fact, it was one of the main theses of my book, my biography of Freud, that Freud, in fact, had an extreme fear of dependency. Jones actually said that independence was the thing he cherished most, almost to an extreme. And I tried to trace it to his own traumatic experience in the first 3 years of life. But one of the reasons he didn't address it, or couldn't address it, I think, was because of his own personal history. And Winnicott obviously went beyond him there. Something that occurred to me in all of this is the old idea was that the resistance to analysis or the fear of analysis was the fear of discovering frightening, tabooed ideas, which is true. But I think there's a deeper fear, and that's the fear of dependence, the dependency that's going to develop in the analytic situation. In fact, Freud says that in Analysis Terminable and Interminable, at least with respect to men, that the reason their analysis can't go far enough is because of their fear of becoming dependent, and specifically dependent on another man. But Jan, I'm afraid I'm going to have to return to what you referred to as the $64 million question here, because we're referring to fear of woman, and you're talking about that fear being based on what the mother's body represents. But how does that play itself out in what you call blended families or in new families where the biological mother is not the primary caregiver? How does that, the fact that mother represents omnipotence and therefore our fear of depending on her, how does that play itself out when the biological mother isn't the actual mothering, one who's providing the mothering or the caregiving?
Yeah, but before I answer that, and I'll answer it more or less the way I did last time. But before answering that, I just wanted to address the notion of regression in analysis, because this is also, I think, something that is so crucial in any analysis. And if the patient cannot regress and the analyst cannot tolerate the regression, then I think a working through of early states of mind is almost impossible. So I do want to bring in how withdrawal to dependency and how Winnicott evolved his ideas of technique, really, and the experience of being with a patient who's regressing to dependency. In answer to the question about rainbow families, I think it's enormously difficult. I don't think we know enough yet. I think we need to do a lot more understanding and research, but I would just go back to the fundamental thing that I don't think anybody would disagree with who's an analyst, that if you deny a reality, then this leads to psychosis, as Freud said.
Okay, that actually provides me with a lead into my next question, which has to do with reality. I'll read it. An older, more scientific and enlightenment-oriented approach to analysis thought that the goal of was based on a scientific model and thought that the goal of treatment was to overcome magic, madness, irrationality, whatever you choose to call it, and replace it with a mature, reality-oriented approach to reality. Now, contrary to some interpretations of Winnicott, I would claim that he, no less than Freud, believed that what he called reality acceptance was the goal of development in analysis. I mean, there are those people, there are interpreters who think that he gave this this notion up, but it's clear in him that reality acceptance was still the goal. In fact, the whole notion of the transitional object is introduced to explain how reality acceptance can come about and be tolerable. But Winnicott also believed that what he called primary creativity and the magic of the mother-infant relationship had to be preserved and developmentally transformed to life, for life to be worth living, which means for there to be aliveness, creativity, continuity, for there to be apperception and fantasy rather than perception and compliance. And as you put it in a very nice phrase in the language of Winnicott, the goal is to maintain a madness which is not psychosis. So would you please tell us what you meant by this and how it's achieved in development, analysis, and life?
I think it was following on from Winnicott saying how the most sophisticated capacity to play was to play with psychosis. And but we have to be very careful how we use this term, I think. But I suppose it must mean what you've talked about, Joel, on your podcast of this series related to magic. Isn't it like theatre? The ability to play means we can indulge in a kind of illusion and not delusion, and make a distinction between. It always amazes me that when the patient arrives, they come, they like the routine of an analysis. Nobody breaks that. It's an illusion. It's a piece of theatre every time we open the door to our patients and they lie on the couch. And yet there's something enormously gratifying as the patient works out their sense of reality from that illusory field, we could say. But I think it is exactly what the mother is able to bring to the infant, this capacity to play and this capacity to continue to evolve beyond the analysis. It's an internalization of that experience of being listened to and being with someone, as I tried to emphasize earlier. And the details of that, I think, is related to an intrapsychic surviving and non-surviving object and the analyst who continues to think and feel and be with the patient in the consulting room.
I think one of the reasons that patients enjoy the or appreciate and enjoy the structure is that because the consulting room is really a liminal space. When you cross the threshold from external reality to the liminal space of the consulting room, the conventional rules of play, so to speak, are bracketed, and it's a realm in which, like a theatrical set. I mean, let's not forget, Freud said that the unconscious was another Schauplatz, and Schauplatz could be another stage. And the analytic setting itself becomes another stage in which things which are not permissible or couldn't be facilitated on the outside are allowed to come out. And let me add here, I think this is one of the reasons why the whole idea that treatment is being done online and that the consulting room isn't being utilized is very problematic. I think something very important gets lost in the process.
Let me just say one thing about that, because I know we're running out of time, but this is what I say in the appendix in The Surviving Object, that in the footnote of the use of an object, Winnicott says, if the patient comes into the consulting room with a revolver, the work of survival of the object cannot take place. And I likened the revolver to COVID-19. But if once COVID is over, we have to have the patient back in the room. We have to. And whilst it's important that patients can use Zoom from time to time, you're never going to have the experience of survival of the object online.
Okay, with that very controversial but very important point, I think we'll end this dialogue. Thank you, Jan.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.